So really, I don't know if I have to say anything else about Catherine. If you know Catherine, you know how involved she is in the program. And so I really do respect Catherine for that. And not only for that, but also because she invited me to her birthday party last week. So it was kind of nice. She informed me that I was on the short list, so she's one of my favorites now. it's now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Her name is Catherine. She came all the way from Visalia. She has a sobriety date of April 3rd, 1995, which means?
2 days
short. I see you see the gears spinning up here. Yeah. Smoke's coming out of everybody's ears. So she's 2 days shy of 20 years, and her favorite AA slogan is keep coming back, and I want to introduce my friend Catherine.
And I am an alcoholic. I have to make a confession. I'm a little nervous tonight. I'm more nervous than usual, and I think it's because I got into my head too much. You know, I took control today, and I figured I was going to decide what I was going to say when I got up here this evening, and that always messes me up. What I was taught when I first came in, that when I was asked to speak, that I should speak and always say yes, and number two, to let God do the speaking to the best of my ability. It's not really about me, although I was thinking about it today as well, that the last time I had the opportunity and the privilege of speaking here to this group, it was made announced that it was the most packed this group had ever been. There was more people there that night than had ever been in this building, so I took full credit. You know, because I've always been that way. I take full credit and want to be the most important person in the room. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because it has definitely taught me how to become right-sized. You know, to give a little history about myself, you know, like Phil said, I came in here and in a couple of days I'll have 20 years. And and the only thing I've had to do for these past 20 years was suit up, show up, and do some work. You know, God did the rest for me. I learned that early on as well, that, you know, all I have to do is the footwork, and God's in charge of all my results of my life. Sometimes I like the results, sometimes I don't, but the most important thing is I've never found a good enough reason to pick up and drink again over anything that's happened over these past 20 years. The book tells us to tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now today. And so I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I was born into a military family. My father was military. My mom was a stay-home officer's wife. And with that, as a child of a military family, that came a lot of responsibility for me, just being a commander's daughter. I had to look a certain way, act a certain way, behave a certain way, and there was a lot of pressure attached to that for me. And the problem being is that I didn't feel like I fit into my family even. You know, I didn't feel like I fit into anywhere in society. I didn't fit in with you guys. I didn't fit in with the friends at school. I didn't fit in with my own family. I honestly believed that I was adopted. And you know, come to find out, you know, I was full of fear from the minute I was born. I think I was just born that way. Everything was all the decisions I made in my life was based on fear. And I'm not sure where that came from. I just know that's who I can still be to this day, just full of fear. Like, I'm kind of fearful about being up here tonight. But over the years, as I was growing up, you know, I did certain things to help me handle that fear. Like my mom said that when I was younger, if they couldn't find me, they would go and look under my bed, and I'd be hiding out under my bed. And I'm not sure what drove me to do that, to hide from people. It's just that's who I was. I didn't want to be around people. And when I was in the third grade, somebody was talking last night. They were sharing for their birthday. And somebody was talking last night about the concept that he started smoking at a young age, and that it altered the way he thought, you know, and who he was, and it gave him the ability to be somebody, make him older and become somebody else. And that's all I've ever wanted to do, was be somebody other than who I am. And so by the third grade, I was stealing my dad's cigarettes and going out to the woods and smoking. And I got a buzz off of it, you know, and it made me feel older, and it made me feel like I fit in, because I would grab up all the other kids and say, hey, come smoke some cigarettes with me. And I was in the third grade. So mine started off pretty young, but I didn't actually choose to pick up that first drink to make a difference in my life. difference in my life until I was 11. And by the time I was 11, okay, back up a little bit, my father was stationed over in Germany, and that's basically where I grew up until I hit the sixth grade and we moved back to the States. And we lived on the German economy, and so, you know, I felt out of place there, and I came back to the States, and I felt really out of place here. Everybody just assumed that I would be just like everybody else. I had never had fast food before. I had never eaten. I can remember eating at Shakey's Pizza, and I'd never heard of a Shakey's Pizza. And so I felt really out of place. But I got to know some people, and the first thing they wanted to do was give me some alcohol and some pills. And so I thought, okay, why not? I had seen my dad drinking, and my dad drank a lot. And so I went ahead and I tried it. And for me, at the age of 11, it was the solution to all that fear I was talking about. It became my liquid courage to be that person, that little girl, that fearful little girl who didn't have to be scared anymore. I didn't have to hide under my bed any longer. It allowed me to do things like become a pom-pom girl, you know, go try out for the play and sing and, you know, be active with other people. I couldn't have done that on my own. You know, there was no way I could have involved myself in any of the stuff that I did. But I wore a really good mask. My family didn't even realize until after I got sober how scared I was my whole life and how people scared me and how I even kind of just scared myself. And so everybody thought that when I was out there doing all these extra activities, being a really good student, that I was able to do that on my own. And in reality, I was drinking the whole time. And starting at the age of 11, I drank, not down, fall down drunk every day, but I drank every day to get mood altered so that I could cope with life on a daily basis from the age of 11 until I was 30 years old when I made it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned in here that I had the inability to cope with life. I did not know how to cope with life. And most importantly, I didn't know how to do relationships. Relationships scared me. Commitment scared me. Allowing someone to get close to me scared me. And so I just was really bad at it. And as I grew up, it became worse because my behaviors along with my drinking started to get worse. And so being a bad person with relationships in the first place, the drinking just made it that much worse, you know. So I went through junior high and high school and made it into college because that's what I was supposed to do. And I went off to college and did okay in college, graduated, and went off to work because I was going to build this career because my thought was so long as I had my own office, carried a briefcase, and wore a suit, I'd be okay. And marry a guy in a suit, then I'd be okay. And everything around me would be fine. But the problem being is that the longer I was out there drinking, the worse my life started to get. The unmanageability of my life started to build up on me. And by the time I did a lot of geographics, and by the time I was in the last few years of my drinking, I had ruined all of my relationships. I think my mother was the only person that would talk to me any longer. I was divorced. I had a 3-year-old son that I didn't know how to raise and on my own. And I was living in Denver, Colorado, and I had lost my job, and I was in financial ruins, and I was lucky on a good day if I weighed 95 pounds. The drinking had took over my ability to eat. I wasn't eating. I was drinking. On a good night, I would treat myself to some popcorn, cheese, and peanuts. Because I thought, peanuts have protein. That's good for you. As I drank it down with my wine or my Jack Daniels or whatever was in front of me. And by the time I got to Denver, Colorado, and I lived there for a few years, I was literally at the point where I could not drink. And I really didn't want to drink. I can remember sitting by myself in my apartment, and I had the last little bit of my Jack Daniels there, and it was there, so I had to drink it. And I really didn't want to. I was watching David Letterman, because that's what I'd like to do, is get drunk and watch David Letterman, and by myself. And, you know, I can remember literally crying, because I didn't really want to drink it, but I knew I had to. And you would think that would be enough for me to kind of get a clue what was going on, but I didn't. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous not realizing that I had a problem with drinking. I had no idea. I just thought I had a behavior problem. You know, I thought I didn't know how to behave right. And the longer I drank, the more I would cross those barriers. You know, I would like say I would never do this my whole life. And the longer I drank, I'd do that. I'll never do this in my whole life. And the longer I drank, then that's the next thing I would do. And by the time I got here, you know, there's certain things that are meant for your sponsors only. I was very embarrassed even to tell one person some of the stuff that I had done. But I did it. And today I'm understanding why I did those things. Back then I didn't understand. I just really believed I was a bad person that didn't know how to do life. And there's something in the book that I related to when I got sober and I read it, and it said, while I was judging myself by my good intentions, the world is judging me by my actions. And that's one of the I related to that right away because I always felt like I had good intentions. I've always been a nice person. I just didn't know how to do it right. And my actions never matched up to my intentions, no matter how hard I tried. In fact, the harder I tried, the worse I made it, and things would get worse. I can remember I was working and at my last job before I got fired or let go, and I didn't want to accept the idea that I got fired, so I was let go. And so, you know, I could remember the gal that I was working with. I had befriended her. I was able to make friends fairly easy. It was just keeping them. That was my problem. I was able to get into relationships and get married pretty easy, but it was just the idea of keeping them kind of hard. And so she wrote me this page, and I actually remember counting them because after I read all of it, this letter she had written me, and I couldn't believe all the stuff she accused me of. And I actually counted. It was like 18 pages front and back, and this woman had to tell me everything that I had done. And what the crazy and the insane part of that was is I actually put that letter down and went, what's her problem? You know? What's wrong with her? And I could never see myself for who I really was. You know, I lived in the book also talks about being in full flight from reality. I could not live in reality even if I tried. My brain actually told me, my disease led me to the idea that I was actually a good mother. My disease actually took me to the place where I actually thought I was a good wife or a good friend, daughter, sister, you name it. I actually thought employee, you know, as I'm drinking there in my office, half drunk, and trying to work. You know, I actually believed, you know, my disease led me to believe that it was everybody else. What was wrong with them? Why couldn't they just accept me for who I was? And that I was actually this good person. Well, I think that was part of my survival tactic of just being able to survive with the things that I was doing and who I was. So, needless to say, things got pretty bad, and I, like I told you, I had lost everything, and I was sitting in my apartment that I just think I thought I was just going to drink myself to death there, because also by this stage, I also didn't care if I lived or not. In fact, I kind of wished I wouldn't. And I also heard this person talk last night, and he said, you know, I was scared to go to sleep because I might die. And the thought that went through my head was, I was scared to go to sleep because I actually might wake up. Because the fear of having to do another day the way I was living, that miserable life that I was living, I just got to a point where I didn't know if I could do it anymore. So my mother talked me into coming to Visalia. I was living in Denver. And said, why don't you come to Visalia and let me help you? And I thought she was crazy because I wasn't sure what kind of help I needed. And she finally talked me into it, and I got here. And according to my mother, she couldn't really believe who walked off of the train, because I took the train over because I thought that'd be a fun trip, and the whole, I don't remember it, I was in a blackout the whole time with my 3-year-old son. And I had to drink the entire trip. And she said she couldn't believe who she saw get off the train. And I'll never forget the look on my mother's face. You know, to this day it almost still makes me cry that my mom had to see me that way. My hair was falling out. I was very sickly. And the first thing I wanted to do was go get a drink. She said she remembered me saying, I need to stop somewhere and get my alcohol. I need to stop somewhere and get some drinks. I need to go get my, you know, bottle of Jack Daniels. Do we have any at home? That was the first thing I said to my mom. And so she brings this woman home that was a total mess. My ex-husband, who had moved to Illinois, came and got my son, who was 3, and just pretty much told me, you know, you need to figure out, clean yourself up and do something different. I'm going to take our son to Illinois, and if you don't do something different, I'll take you to court and get him. So I felt like I had lost my son. And by this time, everything was pretty much miserable. and I was getting ready to turn 30, and somebody had said to me to make me feel better, oh, you're only 30, you know, life's great, you'll be fine, you've got the rest of your life ahead of you, trying to make me feel good. And most normal people would say, yeah, that's right, I still have a long life, you know, I got a lot of life left in me. But for me, I was so empty and so broken at that stage that I couldn't imagine living another day. The thought that I had a long life left to live scared me, and I was exhausted, and I knew I couldn't do it anymore. And so, you know, I became very suicidal and attempted suicide. And where that landed me was in a mental institution for a couple of weeks. And they tried to tell me in there I had this problem with alcohol, but I wasn't ready to hear them. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but I did leave there with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if I stole it or if they gave it to me. I'm not really sure. But when I came out, I still couldn't grasp the idea and wrap the head around the idea that I was an alcoholic. And I met some guys in there, because that's what I used to do. And I was always really good at meeting guys to get what I wanted. And I met this guy in there, and we'd go out to coffee, and he'd tell me, he'd say, you know, he goes, I have this thing called a court card. And he goes, so I have to go to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, you can come with me, and, you know, they can tell you whether you're an alcoholic or not. And I was like, right on, that's what I need to do. I need to go with him. He's got a problem. But he said, no, he assured me he didn't have a problem. And he says, I'm not the one with the problem. But, you know, we could go there, and they'll let you know. And I'm like, okay. So I'm living at my mom's house at this point, and I tell her, okay, I'm going to go find out if I'm an alcoholic. So I leave, and I go to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at the Alano Club, and we sit on the couch, and I sat down to someone thinking, okay, they're going to tell me I'm not an alcoholic. They're going to take one look at me, you know, all skinny, scrawny, sick, hair falling out, and they're going to tell me, ah, you're not one of us. You can go home. And I was going to get to home, go home and tell my mom, you know, I have no problem. I'm not an alcoholic. And that didn't happen. And that's why I keep coming back as my favorite saying, because at first it pissed me off. All that person did was hug me, smile, and said, keep coming back. I was like, oh, you bet I will. And so the next day I went back, sat by someone else, and said, waiting for them to tell me, you're not an alcoholic, go home. And they didn't. They said, keep coming back. And for some reason over the years, I kept thinking it took 2 weeks to go through this process. I don't know. I was in a fog. I don't even know where I tend to exaggerate and lie a lot. I don't know where that figure came from. Eventually it dawned on me, how would I know it was 2 weeks? But I kept going back, waiting for that person to tell me that I wasn't an alcoholic, and nobody would. They just invited me back. And instead of feeling good about being invited back, I was getting kind of pissed off. And I walked out. I stormed out of there because I was drinking before the meetings. I was drinking after the meetings. And in my opinion, you guys were lucky I wasn't drinking in your meetings. So I left there. And at the Alano Club, they have this literature right by the door. When I got sober, they did. And I just kind of had my first God experience, because I had no interest in knowing what you guys were even about. But for some reason, my arm went out and grabbed a brochure before I left there that day, and went home, and what I found out, what I had grabbed was the test. And for some reason, I actually answered those questions honestly. But when I first grabbed it and I saw that it was a test, then I got excited, because I was a good test taker, and I thought, ooh, I'm going to take this test, I'm going to pass it, and then my mom will know for sure I'm not an alcoholic. I'll have it in writing, and it's going to be proved to her. And so I took the test, and like I said, I took it honestly, and I found out I did pass, and found out that I was an alcoholic. And I started crying hysterically, because my perception of an alcoholic is someone that lives on a bench in a trench coat, drinking whatever they're drinking out of a paper bag, and I thought that was the life I was destined for now that I knew. And so I started crying hysterically, and my mom, she's at the other end of the house, and she comes running back to the room, and she's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I hold up this test, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm crying, and she's jumping up and down for joy, going, I know, I know. And so that was the day that I realized that I was an alcoholic. And, you know, thank God that, and thank God, you know, he had led me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew where to go back. And you guys didn't initially kick me out. You guys knew I was drinking. I know you guys knew. I know the people that come in and still drink while they're coming into the meetings. And, you know, I love that, you know, I didn't even have a desire to not drink, but nobody knew that. They just knew that I was showing up to meetings, and nobody kicked me out. And so so I went back, and I sat down, and this time, instead of trying to find that person who would tell me that I wasn't an alcoholic, I went in there, and I actually listened to what people had to say. And some of the stuff I heard was from the readings, which said spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And that was the first time in my life I didn't feel like I had to be perfect. You guys gave me permission to start to learn to live a life where I didn't feel like I had to be perfect, that it was okay to make mistakes, and I just had to get better. And the second thing I heard was, I don't even remember who it was, but some guy stood up at the podium and he said, "You never have to drink again." And that was like a revelation to me. I'd been drinking since I was 11 years old, and I was scared to death not to drink. I didn't know what I was going to do. And so when he said that, I don't know why I bought into that whole concept and that whole idea, but I did, because I saw other people who told me that they hadn't had a drink. And I was remembering this one girl had 6 months, and I was like, that's what I want. I want at least 6 months. I couldn't hear the people who had 20 years. I couldn't hear the people who had 4 years. But the person who had 6 months, I was like, maybe I could do that. I want what she has. So for some reason, because I bought into that idea, I also bought into the rest of the stuff they were saying. And what they were saying was get a sponsor. And I was like, okay. And I was like, what's the sponsor? And somebody had to explain to me what a sponsor was. And so I went and found a gal, and what they told me, and I found out later there's no hard, fast rule of who to ask to be your sponsor, but somebody had told me, you know, go get a sponsor who has at least 3 years, has worked all of the steps, and can help teach you how to do these, learn to live these and apply these principles in your life. And so that's what I did. I'd go up and ask people, how much time do you have? Have you worked your steps? And I finally found someone, and her name was Jody. And she helped get me through the first few steps, and then she had to move. And she had a, and it scared me to death. You know, I was on my fourth step. And I had this lady that I had just started to trust, the first woman or first person in reality that I actually started trusting, and she had to leave. And she goes, that's okay, I've got this other person for you. You can use her. So I said, okay. And she goes, and I've got a little time before I have to go, so we'll finish up your fourth and do your fifth, and then I'm going to have to move. So I said, all right. So I actually did my fourth and fifth with two sponsors because I wanted my old sponsor there because I was too fearful not to have her, and I didn't want to have to redo it with a new one. So I thought that was the best idea. So I actually had two women that listened to my fifth step, and it was a blessing. And God knew exactly what he was doing, because Sue, and she won't mind me using her name, and she's passed away, but she used to always, you know, refer to herself as Sue Noonan. And she became my sponsor, and that is the person that allowed me to learn how to spiritually grow. She's the one that actually taught me how to break down my old ideas, who God is and who he isn't, and what he will do for me and what he won't do for me. And Sue got sick, and so she passed away, and that was really hard. But you know what? I walked through that without having to take a drink. And God put another person in my life. And through the process of having sponsors in my life, I learned the idea and the concept that God will put in my life those people who need to be there for that time, and that not everybody stays around. And that was hard for me at first. I had abandonment issues. I don't even know where they came from. Nobody ever abandoned me. So, but for some reason, I did. I was scared for people to leave me. And but, you know, the things like that, the steps not only taught me how to not drink, because my first year literally was just the idea of how do I not drink today. I just, that was all I needed to know, was I didn't know how not to drink. And so the idea of having to learn the steps to actually change my behavior was foreign to me. My behavior got a little bit better, and all those glaring defects started to kind of stop. But it took many years of practicing on you guys. You know, you guys allowed me to practice all of these principles and these spiritual ideas and these new ways of behaving in the meetings, and I learned how to do it in here, and you guys never kicked me out. And then I took what I've learned in here, and I take it out there now, and I'm actually a productive member of society today. That's that's unreal in my mind. That's a miracle because, you know, since the age of 11 or even before, I wasn't really much used to anybody. And, you know, and so I worked through my steps and I learned how to do this life and learn to cope with life because that was my biggest problem the whole time. I didn't know how to allow other people into my life and I didn't know how not to be scared and I didn't know how to actually accept that there was a God out there that was greater than me that could actually help me get through this. If I live in the third step, my life goes pretty good. You know, and I actually understand that there's a God out there that will actually care for me and has my best intentions in mind and will actually lead me in a direction that's actually the best for me. But I was confused about that concept when I first got sober. They told me not to get married or into a relationship for the first year. So God put this man in my life, and of course it was his will that I get in a relationship with him. And that was my first experience of making my will what I thought was God's will. You know, and I believed it at the time, but looking back, you know, that was truly just my will, you know. And that relationship did not work. And because I had not yet learned how to do relationships. I had not yet, I didn't even know how to really not drink yet. And so I couldn't practice these ideas and these new behaviors in a relationship that I had not even learned yet. So the relationship didn't work out, big surprise. But the good news is that I had stayed very committed to my program while I was in that relationship. I wasn't very good at it, but I stayed committed to it, you know. And I think because of that, I was actually able to survive a divorce. I survived getting married without having to drink. You know, my first marriage, I was in a blackout. I don't even remember my first wedding. And my second wedding, I was sober, and I didn't have to drink through it. And then I didn't have to drink through whatever problems that marriage brought. And I didn't have to drink through the concept that I had to get divorced again. You know, and those were miracles in my life because those were the things that I certainly would be drinking over. And, you know, and for me, after that, I kind of had this misconception that sobriety would bring about a life that was going to be just grand and wonderful and all roses and life was going to be wonderful, kind of like some of those TV shows you see. And I thought, oh, that's the kind of life I'm going to get. But in reality, you know, I've had a lot of struggles. I've had some good times, don't get me wrong. I have had some wonderful times. I've built up some wonderful relationships, which is all I ever wanted anyway, was to have some relationships and people in my life. But what's really fascinating and so important to me is that those hard times that came, I didn't have to drink over them. You know, I got through that divorce. I got through. My son did come back to me when I got sober. I got him back. But then he left at the age of 11 and moved back out with his dad on his own choice. And I had to let my son go again. And I didn't get to see him again as far as living with me until he was 18 and he showed up I watched him get off a plane like my mom watched me and he was a mess, you know, and I didn't have to drink over that. I didn't have to drink over a lot of medical conditions, you know. About 6 years ago, I was actually paralyzed from the neck down and was in a hospital bed at my mom's house again and was in a wheelchair and had to get my way out of that and put it into God's hands because there were days I didn't really believe I would ever walk again. Nobody knew if I would. You know, but the good news is that, you know, no matter what, I don't have to drink over it. God has taken care of this obsession and this compulsion that I have to want to drink to make me not feel. Not to feel better, but not to feel. I didn't know how to feel. I was so numb when I got here. Today I can walk through those feelings. And one of the things I also love is this too shall pass. And I've applied that over and over and over again to my feelings. My feelings, they are not always real, and they too shall pass. They don't stay with me forever. And if I could just sit on my hands long enough and not take a drink and not go out and ruin somebody else's life because of my feelings, and I sit on it long enough, things get better. You know, and I've learned that since I've been here. And what I did for the next, because I had made this man that I married my God, basically, like I always did, trying desperately to do the right things. But what I did from the year 2000 until 2010, I worked on that relationship with a higher power, and I worked on my behaviors, and I really, really started to apply the principles of this program into my life so that I could have a different way of living. And in 2010, when I finally had given up and thought, you know what, I'm okay without having a person in my life. I don't have to have a man. I've got God. I've got a great life. I'm okay with me, which was the first time in my life I've ever been comfortable enough in my own skin to be okay with just being with me. And I worked on all of that process during those years, and when I finally just kind of relinquished the control of thinking that I had to have someone and I was going to go out there and find him, he shows up. And God put somebody in my life again. You know, and this time it was different than the first time. You know, it truly was not me out there seeking. You know, it truly was me just saying, I'm okay with the way things are right now. My life is the way it is, and nothing in God's world happens by mistake. And today I have that life that I've always wanted. You know, that whole concept and idea that I was a good daughter. Today, I'm a good daughter. That whole concept and idea that I was a good mother, today I'm a good mother. And most importantly, I'm a good wife, I hope. He's smiling, so I guess maybe a little. You know, but I do know at least I'm a better wife than I ever been in my whole life. And I know that for me, it is not just about the concept that I don't pick up that first drink, although that's where it begins. For me, it's the whole concept of applying these principles and this way of life into my behaviors so that my behaviors changed. You know, alcohol is just the symptom. My behavior is who I am. I am the problem. And it took me to figure out what was wrong with me. It took me to figure out what I needed to do different, because I really just thought I was a bad person, and I'm not. What I have is a disease, and I got to learn that here. So if you're that kind of person who cannot not drink, if you're like me where you have that obsession and that compulsion starts and the craving starts once you put it that first drink into your body, and you don't know what's going to happen or how much you're going to drink, you have no control over it, you're just like me, and it doesn't make me a bad person. You know, I just thought I was a bad person. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people talk to me about how I have a disease of alcoholism, and you put it into perspective for me that I can live with. You know, you say there is a solution, and I've found that solution, and I didn't find it in meetings, and I didn't find it in anywhere else but into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the first 164 pages. That's where my solution is. But I have to do all parts of that triangle. I have to be in the solution in the recovery part. I have to be in the unity and be part of this fellowship, and I need to be of service. And for me, it takes all three parts if I want the whole pie. You know, if I want the whole thing to work for me the way I want it, I have to do all of it. And I get to do all of it today. You know, and I'm so grateful, because today there is nothing that I would do differently with my life than I'm doing today. You know, I told Phil I'm not going to have a problem talking the whole time, because I'm usually a person that has a lot of words. And for some reason tonight, I came in knowing that I'm kind of sideways tonight. And I don't know why. I think I gave too much thought to this tonight. And I can't stress enough the gratitude I have for Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship that's in there. And I can remember when I first got sober as well, they would say stuff like up at the podium at the Alano Club, people would say, thank you guys are my family. And my first thought was, oh, you poor people, you have to have a bunch of alkies as your family. How sad is that? You know, I thought that was just so sad. But you know what, the reality of it was, as I turned around and I found out, you know, other than my mom, I didn't really have a family. And you guys became my family, and you guys became my foundation. You know, the people that I could count on to understand what it was I was talking about. My mom's a normie. She's somebody that can have a half a glass of wine at night, and I don't understand that at all. She got put on Vicodin as a prescription not too long ago, and she's in the upstairs in the bathroom. I caught her. She's cutting it up into small pieces because she doesn't want to get too affected. You know, she's like so normal. And it just still to this day blows my mind. But, you know, But the cool thing about it is that even though I know she doesn't understand me in a lot of the ways I think, because she says to me, why would you think that way? Why would you feel that way? But today I can accept that she doesn't understand it. There used to be a time that I'd be upset with her that she didn't understand me and she would question me. Today I can go, okay, that's all right. You know, she doesn't understand, but I do know where I can find the people who do understand, who are like-minded like me, who understand why I think the way I do, the way I feel, and you guys always give me, not always, not everyone, most people that I've connected myself up with will always have a solution to how I feel or what I'm thinking, a better idea than what I have. And that's what's important to me, because my ideas to this day can still mess me up. Like today, I was thinking that, you know what, I don't really need to show up tonight. I had it all in my little head how I was going to let Bill know, but thank God I didn't know you weren't out of town. You were supposed to be out of town, but I had it in my head how I was going to contact Bill and tell him why I couldn't come tonight and get myself out of this. And then I remembered, number one, that Bill was out of town and I couldn't reach him anyway. And then number two, I remembered there at the one of the Alcoholics Anonymous AA picnics that they have every June, there was a man who came, and he came on a walker. He must have been 180 years old, and he came from Fresno. And the thing that he said that I absolutely love that kind of keeps me in check was, he goes, you know what? He said, if I was only to do service when it was convenient for me, it's not really service.
Yes.
And, you know, this may not be the most convenient time for where my head's at tonight or where my life is at right now and some of the stuff I'm dealing with. It may not be the most convenient time for me, but I will never, ever forget what I read in the book about what my true purpose in life is, because when I got here, I didn't have a purpose. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a purpose, and the purpose is to be of service to other people and to God. That is my purpose. So no matter what I think is what's best for me, usually it's not. What's best for me is to suit up, show up, do what I'm supposed to do, and hopefully, my only hope is that one person in this meeting tonight may have actually gotten a message that would help you today, especially the newcomers, and I want to welcome the newcomers, and anybody that's under a year old, you know, keep coming back, keep trying to figure it out, and keep practicing. You know, I was so scared of making mistakes, and my sponsor told me, she goes, you know what, without those mistakes, you won't grow. And I've done a lot of growth. I've made a lot of mistakes. That's why I got to grow. And I'm grateful for that kind of stuff, you know, that you guys allow me to make those mistakes. But I'm more grateful that I get to hear messages like that 180-year-old man on a walker who showed up from Fresno who said, you know what, if you're not doing it when it's inconvenient, you're not really doing real service. So I get to do service when I feel up to it, but I also get to be of service to those people when I'm not really feeling in the mood. And so I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous because it's taught me all the lessons in life that I never seemed to understand. I couldn't get it on my own. Somewhere I missed the message when I was growing up. And it wasn't my family's fault. You know, it just basically is who I am. So I want to thank everybody for being here this evening and allowing me to share a little bit of part of myself with you. And I also didn't understand this whole concept either. And I'm going to thank you for helping me to stay sober another day, even if I don't know you, just by you being in this meeting and allowing me to share a part of me with you and what my story is helps keep me sober one more day. And I truly appreciate that because I want to be 20 on Friday. So thank you very much for allowing me to share.